the 18th episode of the 5th season of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It is Tuesday the 23rd of October, and in this episode we are going to talk about Canonical's new secret projects idea and hear another interview from SkyCon, this time with the Linux kernel developer Wolfram Tsang. We will of course cover the latest news, events, a bit about Ubuntu, tomorrow's technology today, and go over your feedback. If you're listening live, you can send us messages using the chat facility on the website and in the IRC channel.
Oh, it's smashy and nicey.
I am Tony, and joining me tonight, well, there are just two other people here in the lovely Ubuntu UK podcast studio. There's no Alan this week because he is sunning himself in Copenhagen.
And eating lots of pastries.
Enjoying very expensive beers and staying in a hotel room which has a clear glass shower cubicle in the corner of it, apparently.
Bathroom cubicle, I think. Ideally
suited. Not staying by himself.
Sharing a room.
Ideally suited for a geek conference. Clear glass shower cubicles. But braving the slightly warm weather here in England is Laura and Mark.
Hello.
So, Mark, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you, Tony.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. What have you been doing since I saw you last?
I've been doing a bit of programming.
Ah, interesting. Anything interesting about that?
Whoa, cracking interview skills.
I've been writing some... Well, basically, I've had an idea for a while where I want to write a zero-player game. Which is a game where basically you sort of set up the initial state of the game and then you say, okay, I'm done, and then it plays the game for you. Which
does that save you all the tedious mucking around
I mean one classic one which people might know about is the Game of Life,
right,
where you set up some blobs and they, according to a predefined rule set, they evolve and change and die and grow.
Yeah.
But then people have made more complicated ones, like there's a game called Progress Quest where you set up an RPG character and then it does all the fighting monsters, getting loot, selling the loot, leveling up and so on for you. So basically I thought it would be fun to do one of those as an exercise.
And how's it going?
It's kind of like Championship Manager.
Yeah,
in principle.
Yeah, yeah, same sort of thing, except you don't, you know, it will trade the players for you and play the games for you.
That dates me, doesn't it? That'd be like 97.
So what's your game about?
Not a lot yet. I've basically just been working on the basics of it and what I'm going to use and how I'm going to build it and how I'm going to make sure it actually works. So I've decided to write in JavaScript because I've never really written anything that big in JavaScript before. So I'm getting used to doing things like unit testing with JavaScript and CoffeeScript, which is a way of making it easier to write JavaScript.
You do know that you're now going to get lots of emails in telling you which program language you should use.
Well, they can all go and write their own game.
It's just a shame that you can't find a zero-player game that writes itself as well and saved you the bother in the first place. Strokes beard.
Strokes beard.
Yeah, but this isn't designed to be actually something which people download and play, really. This is just something to keep me amused.
Fair enough. Laura.
Hello.
What have you been up to?
I went to a symposium.
Ooh. What's one of those?
Well, I just looked it up, and apparently it means a series of talks on a particular subject, which is about right.
What was the particular subject?
History of psychology, which I found quite interesting. And yeah, so things like the history of how we have explained away tears and crying, whether it's biological or psychological.
Or alcohol.
Just got something in your eyes.
Exactly. And the history of the lie detector.
Ooh.
It's quite interesting.
Or was it?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
So, yes, that was me.
Excellent.
And what have you been up to, Tony?
Oh, well, very kind of you to ask, Mark.
Let's move on, shall we?
Oh, okay.
Now, go on.
I saw Alice Roberts from Time Team and lots of other BBC shows as well.
Time Team isn't a BBC show.
From Time Team and lots of other BBC shows.
Right. Sorry. Okay.
I'll say that again. Doing a lecture, she was talking about the megafauna of the Paleolithic era and what happened to them and things. It was really interesting.
Yeah,
we're megafauna. Anything over 30 kilograms is megafauna.
I see.
So you're a megafauna and you're a megafauna.
How dare you?
You're talking into a megafauna.
That's a microphone.
Oh, megafauna.
As the Italians say.
Oh, at this symposium I was at, we had a man with the audience mic called Mac.
Oh,
we've got to get us one of those for our camp.
Yeah. Oh, well, thanks for sharing. Let's get on with the show.
Shuttleworth wrote a blog post and lots of people commented on it, and then he wrote another one and they commented some more.
Sounds most unusual. Wow.
This is about the Skunkworks project idea.
What's a Skunkworks?
Well, somebody commented on this. Apparently a Skunkworks project is generally a project that's sort of off to one side, away from main development, mm-hmm. and not very open. So it's possibly a bad term to use, because this is basically when they get toward, you know, like we get certain things coming out at the end of a release, you know, just before a release.
Yeah, like a shopping lens.
Shopping lens, yeah. Yes.
Or buttons or whatever.
Yeah.
don't write in. the thing is, Canonical tends to work on those things personally, privately,
yeah.
and nobody else is involved. So what they're thinking is making those more open, but obviously keeping the secret surprise. Mm-hmm. For fun. And the people who, and so trusted people, basically members who've shown themselves to work hard and be trusted in the past, can join in those projects and, yes, take part in the fun.
And how was it received, this suggestion of a newfound openness and cooperation with the community?
Mixed.
Right, okay.
Literally. I mean, there are some really positive comments, like, this is a great idea. And things right. like, oh, how do I get involved? I'd really like to do this. Mm. And they're not so positive ideas.
So okay. what are the reasons which people don't like the sound of this?
Well, am start I the only one the who's positives.
Read this? No, but you're the segment starter, so
oh, yeah.
you get to do all the explanation.
Okay,
Alan's
fair.
Not here, so somebody's got to do it.
So I think some of it is that it's called Secret or Skunkworks, which gives people an impression of not being open.
Right.
There's the idea that, or somebody accused it of being an over-the-fence source project.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Well, Novell's allegedly done this.
This is where you sort of, you develop yeah. something internally and then you say, oh, there you go, it's open source now, we've done our bit. And
like iFolder.
Yes.
Yes, things like that. And then,
don't do anything,
don't maintain it, don't...
Yeah. yeah.
Right, okay.
Which doesn't seem entirely accurate here, because they will carry on maintaining yeah. it, because it's still part
it's gonna
of the project.
It's going to be part of Ubuntu, yeah.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, there's that sort of thing. There's just general feeling, I think, that it's not very open just to have these secret projects at all, because obviously people miss out on seeing the development and the evolution of the
yeah.
features.
Mm. So Mark even followed it up with a subsequent blog post to clarify, the following day after his original one, to clarify what he meant. And it seems that his first blog post was really kind of upbeat and chirpy and, you know, vaguely amusing. And the second blog post was slightly more disappointed and grumpy and acerbic. sort of saying things like, it doesn't in any way suggest that the process is closing down the openness of Ubuntu.
Hmm.
You know,
it's opening up the closed bits, hopefully.
The yeah. secret bits.
Yeah, you know, it's makes it more transparent, not less transparent, and gives people a chance to be involved in something they weren't involved in before. Now, it sort of predisposes that you accept the argument that these things should exist in the first place.
Yeah.
Yes, but he does make the point, there's confidential work that happens in every company-sponsored distro, and this is personal work that's revealed when it's ready in a non-company in non-company sponsored distros, people do these things anyway, but just personally. So what he's offering to do is the stuff that Canonical does privately,
yeah,
to make them involved. So it's actually opening it up, but they're not doing anything different from anybody else.
Mm. Yes, in fact, he even says, you know, an individual hacker, unless they're, you know, literally uploading every line of code
yeah.
to a repository as they write it, to a certain extent does some work and then makes it available for other people to look at.
Yeah.
Dumps that over the wall, if you like. So, yeah, I mean, it's an interest. I wonder whether it is a direct response to the people who have accused Canonical of being too closed in some of their development.
in the last, I don't know, 3 years or so.
Yeah.
As we've seen things like Unity, I like the work of the design team and, you know, some of the decisions made around that that arguably had, that hadn't had a lot of say, hadn't had a lot of input from, you know, the wider community. They were just delivered perhaps just before or just after the freeze window.
Mm. So do you think that this is just trying to pay lip service to the community's needs in terms of say, oh, look, we had these people from the community, therefore it's not just canonical? Or do you think they're hoping that actually having these community people on board will make it a better project which will serve the community better in the long run?
I think they hope it will have voices in the community speaking up for these features that aren't canonical employees.
Yeah.
And buy-in.
Yeah. So, you know, it's great if something is announced and Mark writes about it and Jono writes about it. But if you've actually got people from the community who don't have a vested interest in the progress of Ubuntu beyond their own contributions to it, they don't have a commercial interest, say. Even then, some companies could have if they're a support organisation. But that, yeah, they're not canonical, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then it helps to people to say, actually, you know, I was involved in this. You know, the intentions were good, or the intentions were, you know, were honourable, and you know, we designed this, and we thought about this, that, and the other, and you know, there's another voice in the community to help support it.
And there were several comments of people saying, "How do I get involved? It sounds like a great idea." And I mean, for some people, it'd be really good sort of work experience, if you like. Getting stuff on your CV, you can say you did this.
And also just sort of kudos in the community.
Yeah, I mean, you were part of that buzz.
Yeah.
Though he does say something like strap the Teflon on before you start.
Yeah. That's interesting. I wonder what sort of backlash Mark was anticipating when he wrote that.
Well, for the individual developers and that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because,
I was going to say, because if you're associated with a feature that everybody whinges about,
I don't think, yeah, it's maybe not that everyone whinges about. I think it might just be that he's very conscious that there's always some people who are going to say, oh, this is bad for this reason. And if you're going to get involved in something which is going to be public and going to be, you know, made a fuss of when it's released, then you have to be prepared for, you know, both sides. You've got to be prepared for the handful of people who are going to be very vocally against anything. And, you know, let that slide, because there's hopefully going to be a lot of people who are maybe less vocally but supportive of it and happy that it's there. Yeah.
Yeah.
So should we accept that these Skunkworks projects are the right way to do it at all?
Well, I think that it's fair to say they're going to happen anyway.
Yeah. So it doesn't mean we can't express an opinion about it.
Well,
I mean, yeah, is the ideal to have all development, every idea, every little trial of something or other, you know, available in a public repository, or, you know, that people can see and try and find out? That's the open source ideal, surely.
Yeah, I suppose so. I think, yeah, ultimately, that would be wonderful.
But if they're trying to get a commercial edge on it, then, you know, that's why they're doing it, so that they have something they can go, ha, this is what we're doing, this release, and you can't beat me to it.
Some secrets and some surprises.
Yeah, some secret features, and it also gets them the marketing buzz. I think some commenter pointed that out. It's a marketing thing as well.
I suppose, yeah, then you've got the point at which people all blog about it at once, rather than, we've committed some code to this repository every day for the past month, and we've now got something usable, and everyone's forgotten about it.
Also, I guess there's a risk of if you put something up and it is a dodgy build or it just doesn't work very well, people will write it off before they've even tried it.
Yes. Or if they've tried a feature a certain way and it doesn't really work that way. Yeah. Like, for instance, with the shopping lens, maybe if they'd done a release early and it had been even worse than people thought it was when it was released, you know, and then they would have just completely written it off altogether before they got a chance to fix it.
I think sometimes, okay, with the shopping lens and the privacy issues and stuff, I can see you could say yes or no, or that could influence it. Some of the other things are more subtle design decisions. And first of all, if you have loads and loads of people involved in the design, it really inhibits what you can actually come up with. But also, you shouldn't be designing by a committee, because you end up with just a monster. You could, you know, if you, I think if you give people enough time to criticize everything, the design team or whoever will get completely worn down by all the criticism and then lose sight of what they're actually trying to achieve because they're trying to satisfy everyone.
I've certainly seen it before where there's been a discussion about a very specific thing and there's just been so many opinions that no decision could ever possibly be made about it.
Yeah.
So that said, if you've got a good process to manage it, you can still do that in an open way rather than having it have to be secret. It's just a case of having the right people who the people who will say, you know, right, I've listened to enough opinions and this is what we're going to do before it gets out of hand.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Mark makes very clear is they're looking for people with sort of proven skills in certain areas. Mm. Mm. It's not just somebody saying, oh, I fancy a go at design.
Yeah.
Give me a whiteboard and a crayon and let me at it. Yeah, they're looking for people who've got skills in their area, whether it's crypto, whether it's design, whether it's some sort of fundamental kernel architecture thing, cloud stuff, whatever it might be. So there's obviously going to be questions around who gets in and who gets out and, you know, how should you be just looking for people who've currently got the skills or people who are perhaps just interested but want to develop skills and, you know, all sorts of things that spring to mind around that. But it's not just going to be, you know, inexperienced, keen people volunteering to, you know, design the next version of Unity or whatever.
Yeah, and one of the comments on RSC from Saberwolfie is that people are working all the time really hard on bug fixes and the standard features, and you shouldn't take too much of the focus away from those people who are also doing good work just because they're not doing the glamorous, sexy work.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because it will be those Skunk Works projects, as they will no doubt be known, that get all the attention. And, you know, the fact that somebody's working very hard fixing LibreOffice, bugs in LibreOffice, is not going to get a lot of attention and praise.
But
people don't always do it for attention and
praise. Yeah, I was going to say, if there was no canonical Skunk Works projects, the people doing LibreOffice bugs still wouldn't get a lot of attention and praise. It's not a zero-sum game like that, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Or fortunately.
Indeed. Super Engineer asks, hopefully rhetorically, having announced it will happen, which he doesn't see as a bad thing, will announcements be made on the progress of said Skunk Works? Well, presumably, the whole point of them is that you won't know they're going to happen until they do land.
Yeah. I mean, we've got some vague ideas of the areas they're in.
Yeah, but we know, for example, that there's work been going on TV and mobile, tablets, that sort of thing. But nobody outside of Canonical has seen... the TV interface has been previewed, but the mobile and tablet stuff hasn't been seen by anybody outside Canonical. So... yeah, that's the sort of thing that they were talking about doing, presumably.
And one of the sort of nice small parts is that they're not expecting community people to do NDAs.
Oh, yes.
So don't have to do non-disclosure agreements. They're just trusted, basically. Mm. That's why they're looking for people who have a proven record.
Yeah, I thought that was a really nice way of handling it. It always gets difficult when people have to sign NDAs, particularly if they are just volunteers helping out for this sort of thing. And it's also interesting as to what sort of aspects they can get involved in. Are they going to be, say you are developing, I don't know, a feature, are you going to be able to contribute code? Are you contributing ideas? Are you just giving feedback?
Yeah,
are you reviewing what they've done and
it?
Giving feedback? Mm. Yeah, what sort of level can you get involved in these things?
I think it did say something about coding. You have to be able to get down and do some coding reliably and that's testable and well tested and that. So presumably quite involved. Mm. And I can't remember what I was going to say.
No, that's fair enough. Cool. Well, if you're listening at home and you've got some thoughts on the Shuttleworth Skunk Works project, that's what we're going to call them, send in your feedback to podcast@ubuntu-uk.org, or you can get in touch using any one of the number of mechanisms that we talk about on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, and at the end of the show.
And now it's time for the news. The secure boot saga continues with Matthew Garrett responding to the Linux Foundation's proposed solution with derision.
That sums it up.
He is the most chilled man in Linux.
No. Garrett suggests that the Foundation's proposal treats Linux as a second-class citizen and is much less preferable than the solution being implemented by SUSE and Fedora.
Yes, because the SUSE Fedora solution...
Sorry, I fell asleep.
It's bootloaders! This stuff's important!
One of them has a nice UI and one of them can't reboot by itself.
One of them is a one-off thing you do during the install.
Yeah, which is okay.
To authorize it, and which is the SUSE and Fedora one. And the other one means you have to hit yes every time you want to boot your PC.
That would be annoying.
Which is what the Linux Foundation are coming forward. So I agree with Matt Garrett on this one. It seems to be a suboptimal solution, although, swings and roundabouts in all cases. The Linaro project has created a tool designed to build boot time monitoring into the Linux kernel.
Yeah, my booting.
The tool... hit Y. The tool, appropriately named Boot Time, is hoped to be included in the mainline kernel and will render standalone boot tools like Boot Chart obsolete.
What? Sorry?
It's benchmarking.
Yeah,
and
Boot
profiling.
Chart was a thing you could add a special grub entry where if you booted using that grub entry, it would make a nice graph of how quickly all of your processes started.
I remember.
Yes.
Yes.
That was quite cool.
So this is basically, instead of doing that, you'll just have a node on your file system where you can just say, tell me how long it took my system to boot, and it will tell you.
And which bits took up most time and things.
I guess so, yeah.
Mozilla has published details of security measures in Firefox 17 onwards, which will block outdated versions of popular plugins such as Flash and Adobe Reader from displaying content. If the currently installed version of the plugin has been identified as a security vulnerability, it can be blacklisted, requiring the user to manually run the plugin content by clicking it until the plugin is updated.
Does this hit the right level of annoyance for people to actually make them upgrade to the secure version?
I don't know.
It seems like it could do. It could be just enough annoying enough that they'll go away and actually find what they're supposed to upgrade and do it.
When you see it's the same sort of display as when the plugin crashes. Like if Flash crashes halfway through playing a video and it displays a little unhappy face and then you have to reload the page or something like that. It's that same sort of screen. So it makes you think, oh, something's broken, I need to fix it.
It'd be good if clicking it would actually just install a new version.
There is a link that says, but obviously it depends on what plugin it is and where it comes from as to whether you can have that.
This happens to me on a piece of software we have at work, web-based thing, and I need to install a new JRE, I think, for it. And it tells me this every time, but I hate installing Java. It just all never works. So I just click the button and live with it.
Fair enough.
Miguel de Casa has announced Mono 3.0, the latest version of the open source implementation of Microsoft's .NET framework. The new release supports numerous behind-the-scenes improvements, as well as some major new features such as support for the .NET asynchronous API and support for Microsoft's open source web frameworks.
Oh, good.
Tomboy will work well.
Yes, they've enhanced the Tomboy functionality in Mono.
Excellent.
Brilliant. And after 38 years, the BBC's Retro Text Interface News Service, CFAX, will be ending tonight as the last analog transmitter in the country analog TV transmitter in the country is turned off over in Northern Ireland.
Huzzah!
Have you ever actually used CFAX, Mark?
I used to use it to look up TV listings when I
was... Yeah, I did.
I
remember we used to play a quiz game on it.
Oh, there was one button on the remote, which was reveal teletext answer.
Oh, something like that. It took forever for each question to come up.
Yeah.
But the geek aspect of this, the reason I included it, was that when I got taught to program on a BBC Micro, I was doing all different coloured text and backgrounds and realised this is how CFAX is made. I could make pages that look like CFAX.
Yes, now we have the internet.
This was before the internet when I was at Guides.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that.
I did my computer badge.
That's the end of the news.
But we have some events.
Yay.
If you're a woman who'd like to get to...
I'm not quite sure about the phrasing of this, but...
If you're a woman who'd like to get to grips with open source development in a supportive atmosphere, we, not us, the organisers of this event... Is this Flossie?
I will don't think so.
There is an event running
people as yet unnamed.
By people as yet unnamed. An open source taster with 3 days of tours, talks and hands-on workshops. That's the 29th to the 31st of October at the National Museum of Computing, Bletchley Park.
Yay!
Cool. There are still a few tickets left.
It is flossy.
It is flossy.
Oh, brilliant. Okay. Yeah.
And you get to make a simple Android app. Yeah. Look at Drupal.
Look around the museum, of course. And yep. It's just £15 for the whole 3 days.
That's pretty cheap.
That's £5 per day.
And Bletchley Park is very cool to visit.
Yeah, that's really good value. Mm. Must cost more than that to get in. And yes. On the 1st of November, in that there London, there's a Red Hat Developer Day.
Yes.
You can use the discount code REDHAT20 to get 20% off. I wonder if there's a Red Hat 99 discount.
You could
code.
Always try it. But yeah,
worth
this is
a shot.
Red Hat people showing you about Red Hat technologies. Like it's all focused really on sort of cloud stuff. So doing things like deploying stuff on OpenStack and using their cloud development platforms and things like that. There's other stuff as well.
Is that a thing like that where that Red Hat sales rep started slagging off all of the people who are on a conference call? Is that where this happens, this sort of thing?
I'm unaware of that.
I don't know.
Okay. Well, why don't we listen to Tomorrow's Technology Today, and I can tell you all about it.
Hello. And welcome to Tomorrow's Technology Today. I'm Douglas Austin Cambridge. Good day to all our listeners, wherever you are around the British Empire. As I say to my delightful co-host, Miss Deirdre Morris-Oxford, with what are we going to begin today, Deirdre?
We began several hours ago with hypnotherapy, Douglas.
Really? I don't remember that. I say, old girl, have you seen my wallet?
That's because I hypnotized you, Douglas.
Don't be silly, Deirdre. No one would ever be able to...
Sleepy. Wake up!
No, don't hit me, Father. Oh, what happened?
Hypnotherapy, Douglas.
You're not banging on about all your weirdy mumbo jumbo again, Deirdre. What was it last week?
Regression therapy.
Oh yes, hypnotizing people back through past lives. What can anyone learn from past lives?
You seem to think you were Florence Nightingale.
That was just another nickname from school.
You seem to be quite affected by it.
You don't understand, Deirdre. Boys can be so cruel.
And what about Napoleon?
Napoleon was Father's beagle.
You wanted to be a beagle dog.
Father always loved that beagle more than me.
Are you all right, Douglas?
I never wanted to go away to boarding school.
Perhaps you should have a lie down on the couch, Douglas.
I can't. I'm not allowed on the couch in case I leave paw marks.
You're not a beagle, Douglas.
I'm just going to hug myself quietly in this corner.
Oh, that's all from Tomorrow's Technology Today. Toodle pip and God save the king. Pull yourself together, men. Remember you're British.
I'm here at SkyCon with Wolfram Sang from Pengotronics. How are you doing?
Oh, fine, thank you very much.
Good, good. So you're a kernel developer. How did you get involved in kernel development?
I do computing since I was a child. I was starting with a Commodore 64, doing very low-level stuff, and I really enjoyed that, and I wanted to do this as a job. And so when it was due to what do I want to do, what was my job, I wanted to do low-level computing, and I wanted to do free software development because that's a passion of mine. And so that combination led to embedded Linux development.
And you're the maintainer for the I2C subsystem. What's that about?
That is an industrial bus. It has two wires, and it's pretty slow, but it's pretty efficient to talk to sensors or what. Something, devices like that, and it was the first subsystem I came into contact with when I entered Linux kernel development. And yeah, the maintainer was friendly and guided me into this, how to communicate with the kernel community. And yeah, from that, I kind of stayed in that subsystem until I took the, or I was asked to be a maintainer of that subsystem, which I happily do.
So you've been talking today about people getting involved in kernel development. There are a lot of developers in the room today when you ask them, but a lot of them, none of them had done any kernel development. Why do you think that some people who are experienced developers find it difficult to get into kernel development?
Maybe. I think some are afraid because if they do something wrong, I mean, if you have an application going wild and you get a segmentation fault and the application is gone, you restart. But if you do something wrong in the kernel, you get an oops and you have to reboot the machine. Maybe some people are even afraid that they destroy the hardware or stuff like this. And also some people think because it's an operating system, it by definition must be complicated code. And my talk was about that there are core components in the kernel which really are complicated, but there are not enough outside areas which are easy to handle, where people can step in, play around with drivers or whatever functionality they need, and that they don't need to be afraid to enter the kernel space.
So the idea of people finding it difficult to get engaged with kernel development is a bit of a myth, you think? It's actually reasonably accessible to get started?
Yes, I think it's, well, some kinds are more myth than others, but in general, the kernel is a quite important part in the free software world, and so there is lots of documentation. You can get the information you want. There are people around experienced who like to share their experience. There is lots of infrastructure you can use, like the history of the repository or stuff like this. So I think if you want and if you're not afraid, then you can get all the help you want to enter the kernel space. And this is really, really wanted because I think private participation in the Linux kernel development is very important.
There is an idea now that all of the contributions to the kernel, or most of them, come from private companies, from Red Hat or Intel or HP or Canonical or whomever. But you showed some statistics showing that most of the 10% of the changes were coming from hobbyists, I think, in one of the last kernel versions. Why is it so important to have hobbyists still involved?
For a number of reasons. For me, it's one. It's to, we have the freedoms of free software, and one of them is to study the source code, and I think this needs to be done in practice. So we need people who have the exercise the code somehow. So it's not proprietary, it's not a corporate thing, so it's a private thing. And it's also a bit of crowdsourcing. I mean, the people out there have lots of different hardware. No developer has access to such a broad variety of hardware. And if people have that and test patches or fixed drivers which does not work on their specific laptop or whatever, it's really helpful to have a good and stable and mature Linux kernel.
You talked before about there being 1,000 developers on the kernel at the moment. That has to lead to conflict sometimes. Does that put people off?
There is one of the myths that kernel developers are maybe arrogant or grumpy. Some of them are, but that's quite normal. I mean, if you have 1,000 people around you, you have a high chance that some of them are grumpy, kernel developers or I don't know what. But the general thing is that you work on a technical level, and if you remind people, even if you something looks like it goes into a flame war, remind people that all of us are working to create a very good operation system and maybe the best in the world. And so, okay, let's get back. What do we need? How can we solve it? What are our approaches? Where do we disagree? Where do we agree? And you can find a solution. But I want to express that most of the time it was fun for me developing, working with people over crossing borders, be it company borders or countries, working with people in China, talking with them how to fix bugs. That's a really fun thing to do.
Do you find that there is some tension between people from different companies, or do they all generally get on okay most of the time?
It looks like there could be tension, but in general, it's working perfectly. There are people working from companies you know are competitors in most areas, but on the kernel side, they're working together to get the problem done.
So if I have got a bug, say, with a network card driver in my computer, and I am a C developer, or at least have C skills to be able to try and fix it, I think I've fixed it, I've developed a patch. How do I go about getting that into the kernel? What should I do?
There's documentation about that even inside the kernel. There's a file called Submitting Patches, which clearly describes what to do. The first thing is to find out which people lists and people to send it to. There's also a script helping you to identify the people. Then it's about sending it properly, no line breaks and whatever. And then just be persistent, be there. If there are questions, fix it, discuss your solution. If there's no response, which what sadly happens because people are overloaded, then just be politely persistent, ask a week or 2 weeks later, hey, I got this patch, it really solves a problem for me, any commands, and be there to respond to this, to that, and sooner or later you will have your patch on the mainline kernel.
So if you submit a patch and there isn't something quite right about it, hopefully somebody will give you some feedback and say, this is good, but you need to do this, that, and the other to fix it and make sure it's up to our standards before it'll get in.
Yes, there's a variety of how people do things. Some really point out you have to do this and this and give you a step-by-step description. Others give you only pointers where you can have a look how to do it properly. In some rare cases, they also fix it for you, because sometimes it's faster to fix it yourself than to explain someone how to do it. But you still see the result and can learn from that. And that's usually the way it goes. I mean, it's helpful to educate people.
Cool. So the kernel uses a program called Git to manage its version control, so code and patches and that sort of thing. How much work do you need to put in to learn that before you can start development?
If you want to get into kernel development, you don't really need Git. It's just one tool. You can simply go to the kernel.org website, download the tarball, and work on that source code. I would recommend using some kind of source code management, but you can start with something easily accessible like Qt or Qt. And if you keep at it and you get more kernel stuff done, then you will probably feel the need to have something more advanced, and then you just slip into Git and learn the basics and the stuff you need, but learning by doing, and then you will find out that it's not impossible to master. It might be a learning curve at the beginning, which is a bit steep, but nothing which cannot be managed.
Cool. You talked before about sometimes not getting a reply because people are overloaded and overworked. Is that a problem? Are there not enough people working on the kernel at the moment?
There are a lot of people working on the kernel at the moment, and that's where I see a potential problem coming up, because we I see an increase in people working, producing code, producing patches, which is rising, because sometimes there's these R&D developments from bigger companies, but the amount of people who review patches, who accept patches, the maintainers, are not increasing in the same rate, so that does not scale too well, in my opinion. And I think we need to pay attention how to properly deal with it, so patches get accepted in an acceptable amount of time.
Who drives the direction of the kernel? Who decides what features are going to get included and what isn't appropriate for inclusion?
The first is the maintainer of the subsystem. So if somebody wants a new feature in the I2C subsystem or I2C driver, then I'm going to decide if that's needed or not after a discussion on the list. Maybe sometimes I've been convinced to accept something. And then I pass it on to the next level. And in my case, I send a pull request directly to Linus Torvalds, and he can decide to have another look or not. Usually he trusts the people he get pull requests from, but he also skims through the change logs and what happens. And he still can reject something if he doesn't like it. And if he's okay, it will end up in history, and then it's in the mainline Linux kernel.
So how do you make a decision if a feature should be included in the subsystem that you maintain?
It's a bit... I must see a need for that. There is sometimes a danger of over-engineering stuff, so if there's a feature going to be submitted, I definitely need a user of that feature. Mm. And then I have a use case, and then I can decide, okay, I think this is a reasonable approach or not. This has also to do with experience, and as I said before, it's also the end. It's the outcome of a discussion. If I think this is not needed, and people describe the use case, and I might be convinced.
So there's a new kernel every 3 months, I think. How does that process work? How do you decide what's going to go into the next kernel release?
The process is like this. After some kernel was released, for the next kernel there's something called a merge window, which is roughly about 2 weeks, and only in that time new features are allowed, new features or massive changes. And then we have roughly about two and a half months until the final kernel comes out, and this is the stabilization phase. In that phase, only bug fixes are accepted to get all the new features properly done and make sure there are no regressions, and a lot of time is spent into that to ensure that we have a stable kernel released when it is due.
So the 2 week window is a busy period.
Extremely busy, because everyone is paying attention that his changes are going into the mainline kernel, and then you sometimes have cross dependencies between all the subsystems, and they need to be sorted, and you have to pay attention that the merge conflicts get solved properly, and all that. There's something called Linux Next, which makes it easier, because you can always anticipate in Linux Next what is going to happen, but still the merge window is a really, really busy period for maintainers.
I was just going to ask, what does happen if you have a development that touches a number of different subsystems? Do the maintainers of those subsystems, communicate about whatever the feature is and make sure that it's not going to break other parts, or how does that work?
Yeah, there's a lot of communication needed, and it's usually you're not allowed to touch to change something in a subsystem for which is not yours. If you want to do that, you need a special acknowledge from the maintainer of that subsystem. So, and that's part of the discussion. Which tree is this massive change touching a lot of things going in? Okay, we decide on yours, and I give you my acknowledge. Okay, you can change files in my subsystem. I'm okay with them.
Cool. So after 2.5 months of stabilization and bug fixes, it becomes a release, and Linus makes that decision?
Yeah, and there are no strict rules about being exactly 2.5 months. He needs to have a feeling that this kernel feels good, and oh no, there's still that problem. Let's try another week of stabilization, and well, he then decides, okay, it's out now, a new merge window is opened.
Cool. So if somebody out there is listening to this and thinks, oh, I'd like to have a go developing things in the kernel or fixing bugs or whatever it might be, what's the first thing they should do? What website should they go to? What mailing list should they sign up to?
The first thing would be to get some source code for the kernel. That could be a tarball, which is on kernel.org, or they check out the Git repository, which is also on git.kernel.org, probably the Linux repository. And if people wonder where should I start, I mostly suggest scratch the thing which are itching you. Mm-hmm. So if you have a button on your laptop which does not work properly, try that, because that keeps the motivation high to really get something done. Mm. Something like that.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much indeed for talking to me, and best of luck with all the future kernel development.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the interview.
it's time for a bit about Ubuntu.
Go!
Nobody is going to give you the pleasure of an Ecosphere or Gerald.
Yay! So Ubuntu 12.10, the Quantal Quetzal, except there.
Quetzal.
The quick has been released. Yay!
Cool, has anyone Excellent. Used it yet?
I have not.
It just finished downloading last night, so we haven't tried it yet.
Okay.
Yeah, I normally like to be a bit ahead of the curve and have my mirror running for a few weeks before so it doesn't hit the thing on release day, but I forgot. And only when the announcement release hit the news did I remember that I hadn't done it. So we have now got it available to install.
Our mirror at work got overloaded. Some Debian users got very unhappy that they couldn't get their updates because everyone was upgrading to Ubuntu. Or upgrading Ubuntu, rather.
Yes.
Is that mirror.ac.uk? Or no. Is that a local mirror?
That's a local mirror.
Right, okay.
Well, Excellent. As local as you get. Anyway, yeah, Canonical has released a web interface for Juju.
Yes, this looks really quite nice, actually.
Explain Juju briefly.
Juju is basically a nice way of packaging scripts which set up servers for you on top of... well, ideally on top of OpenStack.
Yeah.
So you can have an OpenStack server room or data center, and you can say, I want, I don't know, 5 web servers with a load balancer in front and a MySQL backend, and it'll go bup-bup-bup-bup and set it all up for you.
It's like apt-get, but for cloud servers.
Yes.
Ah, yes.
For the cloud. We interviewed George Castro yes. about it earlier this season, I think.
I yes. think so, yes. when we were at Mark's house.
Yes.
Yes.
Studio J.
C.
Studio F, you know.
But yes, so this is cool because it means that now people don't have to be comfortable with the command line to be able to set up servers.
And it looks quite pretty. So you can see a little graph of which services are installed where and what they're doing. And
got lines and boxes, but in a pretty way.
Yeah. So, yes, no, it's good to see that. And it was one of the things that Mark Shuttleworth was talking a lot about at SkyCon a couple of weeks ago. So it is one of the major parts of the Ubuntu platform yeah. strategy going forward, as they would say.
When does the check come through?
Going forward.
Yeah. Mark Shuttleworth, speaking of whom, has announced that Ubuntu 13.04, so that's the next release, will be called the Raring Ringtail, and the upcoming development cycle will have a big focus on the move to mobile, tablet and TV form factors. There also have been some hints and glimpses of Ubuntu running on Google's Nexus 7 tablet.
Which is quite exciting, because I'm holding one of those in my hand.
Not running Ubuntu at the moment.
Not as of yet. Yeah. It sounds like UDS, which is next week,
yeah.
There's going to be some more details arriving then, by the sound of it.
Yes, UDS now really is a thing where people announce stuff.
It's a bit like an Apple conference.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, so rather than kind of used to be sort of lots of people sitting in rooms talking about things, and it still is that, but there's this whole extra thing of the attention paid to the keynotes and stuff, and the idea that some things are going to be released or revealed. So the ringtail is a type of raccoon.
Raccoon, yes.
But he didn't call it a ringtail, the raring ringtail raccoon, because that's too long. Too many R's.
3 hours.
Yeah, you got to be careful.
Simon Redmond says he's just been to Nuki Zoo and there's not a ringtail in sight.
Oh.
Disappointing.
Yeah.
The team that works on Ubuntu TV have called for more active participation from the community.
Ooh.
They've set up a website and everything.
Ooh.
And so, we'll link to it.
Okay, so what are they looking for people to do?
Stuff.
I think they want people to install it on the box connected to their TV and play around with it and give feedback and work on stuff.
They specifically want help with 3 things at the moment. One is recreating the TV user interface using the Nux toolkit, which is part of Unity.
Because it's been using QML up until now, hasn't it?
Indeed.
Which is what 2D. Unity 2D used, which is now going away.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they want the 3D, fully 3D version. Integrating a Myth TV backend into the TV UI, meaning live TV tuning. The electronic program guide and recording infrastructure, which is quite interesting that they're using Myth TV, or at least making it possible to use Myth TV as a back end, because I would have thought they would have probably written their own from scratch. But
Myth TV works.
Yeah, why you do that when
it does, but it's quite complicated.
But if they tricky. Could take the bits that they need.
Yeah, if they can make it smooth. Then
get rid of the UI. That would be great.
It's not the front-end UI on MythTV. It's the setup and the tuners and the program guides data sources and stuff. Anyway, looking for help doing that and researching and finalising the hardware acceleration of GStreamer video syncs for NVIDIA, Intel and AMD graphics cards, not only enabling the TV to have hardware-accelerated video playback, which is pretty much a must.
Yeah.
For FreeView, particularly HD, but also anything on the Ubuntu desktop that is built using GStreamer. So there you go. So if you're interested in getting involved in any of those three things, you can find out more on the website, which we will link to from our show notes.
As Windows XP approaches end of life, Canonical's been pitching Ubuntu as an alternative upgrade path to Windows 8.
Yes, quite blatantly.
Yes, quite as in literally the website says, avoid the pain of Windows 8, Ubuntu. Yes.
They're not going for subtle.
No.
Windows 8 is coming. If you want to avoid it, then, you know, do this Ubuntu thing.
I saw quite an interesting sort of tour of the user interface of Windows 8 saying how similar a lot of the things were to Windows 3.1 in terms of... there's not a start menu anymore, but you can go through programs and create your own shortcuts and pin them to the taskbar yourself like you used to do.
Okay.
And how the, like... Because completely unrelated, there was a video of someone upgrading through every version of Windows ever and showing how it all works and how, like, apps from really early Windows versions still run on the modern versions of Windows.
Okay.
But the calendar app in Windows 8 requires a Microsoft account, whereas the calendar from Windows 3.1, which still runs on Windows 8, doesn't require a Microsoft account.
Interesting. So somebody's actually got some... hardware that they can upgrade everything from 3.1.
No, it was from Windows from Windows DOS, 1. Install Windows 1, upgrade all the way through, skipping out ME because there was no upgrade.
Right.
It's just kind of the poor cousin, wasn't it? That everybody ignored.
So you went 98 to 2000 or 98 to XP, presumably.
To 2000 to XP, yes.
Okay.
Cool.
Excellent.
Anyway, back to Ubuntu.
Yeah. Meanwhile, back at the point. The developer of Ubuntu Tweak, which is the utility for customising Ubuntu, various settings and things that are hidden under the covers, announced that he was going to be stopping development on the project because he had other things to do with his time, basically, but was encouraged to keep it alive after an outcry from the community. So that's good in a way.
As long as he can keep the enthusiasm that he got from the outcry.
Yeah, I think it's obviously been a bit of a shot in the arm for him to keep going. You know, and a few people actually do use it, and you don't always see that if you're developing an open source product.
Exactly. I mean, having been in a similar situation myself where I've developed something and just sort of let it sit, actually having people come along and say, oh, yeah, we use it, it's great, is a real sort of driver to get you to carry on doing stuff with it.
It would be better, of course, to build up a full kind of community around it.
So other people who can...
Take it
do
over.
The work.
Because basically the thing is he's got a job, a full-time job now, and hasn't got as much time to give to this community project, which is fair enough, and, you know, isn't going to change.
Yeah.
It's just at some point he'll want to do other things with his time, I guess. But, you know, good while it lasts, and hopefully other people can get involved.
And Ubuntu GNOME Remix 12.10 has been released.
Yeah, so this is a full-on remix of Ubuntu using GNOME 3 instead of Unity.
Yes. Which is interesting for the Unity haters.
Yeah.
You can become GNOME haters as well.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's very different from GNOME 2. So, you know, what are you going to do about that?
And we have some not about Ubuntu news.
Yes.
A couple of Fedora stories.
Yes, facts about Fedora, I think I'll call it.
Ooh.
Fedora fun.
Yes, Fedora had a tool called Smolt, which was a system for doing a census of the hardware that it was being run on.
Yeah.
And they're retiring that because they don't think it's the right way of doing it.
Which is interesting.
Yes.
Because Ubuntu thinks that's the right way to do it.
Yes.
So does Ubuntu get a higher share than Fedora on this tool?
I don't think they use the same tool. I think it's just the methodology for gathering the hardware data. I don't think it's like, this tool is no longer giving us the results we need, let's stop using it.
I didn't really think they did, but it's quite amazing still.
Okay.
And also in the Fedora world, the release of Fedora 18 has been delayed by another week. apparently it's been delayed by several weeks already.
Yeah, apparently they're focusing...
It's not ready yet.
Stop. This distro is not ready yet. They are getting their developers to focus on the upcoming Red Hat Enterprise Linux release rather than Fedora.
What number is that?
And apparently, imagine this, apparently they can't do the release without the Red Hat people facilitating it.
What, Fedora?
Mm.
Aren't most of the sort of developers on Fedora Red Hat people? That was my understanding.
Well, kind of, yeah.
Like, you couldn't do a release of Ubuntu without the Canonical people.
I know, that was my point.
Oh, I see.
But, you know, compared
to... But Canonical, well, there is only one Ubuntu. There's not a separate one which the Canonical people are more interested in.
Yeah, yeah. It was just interesting to see how the corporate stuff can influence the progress of the community distro, Fedora. Yeah. But, yeah, there's always been a really close link there. Anyway, that's all we have in the bit about Ubuntu and not about Ubuntu this time.
Now it's time for your feedback. And Wub wrote in to say,
I have approximately 2 cents worth of response to Tony's, I think it was Tony's question about whether new users would be put off by the appearance of ads on their brand new shiny homepage. My thinking runs something like this. At an earlier point in the podcast, Tony pointed out a distinction between ad-supported software and the shopping filter that, as far as I understand the argument, hinges on whether the underlying mechanism serving the ads is profiling the search terms or not. How is the average new user going to be able to evaluate that? I feel that they are simply going to see that their desktop is serving them ads that seem to be related to all the searches they are doing. This would probably strike me in much the same way as ads inside a game I was playing, in the sense that I wasn't necessarily expecting them, don't understand why this game has ads when other games don't, and can't turn them off. I believe that this would make Ubuntu appear cheap, as every search I make, even inside my local drive, is somehow being monetized. Whether that is a fair impression or represents Canonical's actual intentions is not for me to say. I will say that I departed from Ubuntu when Linux Mint 12 was released.
Can I just say Tony isn't the Wing Commander? So I think he fancies himself as that.
I was just
I can suggest how a user might evaluate what they're doing with the data, because there's a thing on the dash, you click a link and it tells you.
Oh, right.
Alan told us about that last week, I think.
Right.
They added it after people were saying, oh, privacy concerns, what's going on? And it'll explain where your data goes and you can turn it off.
It's like a legal notice thing,
yes,
isn't
that's
it?
The one.
Yeah, that's the one. Right,
then,
yes. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, it is an interesting point, I think, about making it appear cheap, like as an ad-supported software.
Hmm.
Not in the same way as an Opera or whatever with an ad bar in the menus, in the toolbar as it used to have. But yeah, I wonder whether there's an impression that people might get erroneously. Well, it's free, but you know.
Yeah, I was going to say, it is cheap. It's very, very cheap.
Yeah.
But it's trying to compete with less cheap software.
Mm.
Ben Dowell says,
I realise I'm too late for the competition, but my suggestion to improve Ubuntu would be to make speed dial like copy and move to locations, which can be easily assigned for quick file sortation without multiple open windows via the right click. Does anyone?
No.
Okay. Thank you for your suggestion. I ran Ubuntu 12.04 from a 16 gig micro flash drive and love the way it will switch between laptop and netbook or any other computer I wish to run and still have plenty of room for user files. A very cheap way to speed up an old netbook and a really portable environment. Thanks, Ubuntu.
Well, that's an interesting idea. I know people who used to use, what was the KDE Live CV?
Nopix.
Nopix.
Yes.
You used to use Nopix and a USB stick
as
their
kind
of portable environment. Did you? Oh,
yeah.
Right, okay.
And Alan has that little tobacco tin with a million USB sticks, which he can, depending on what he needs to do with any computer, he can just sort of plug in various things and...
Oh, I've forgotten he had that. I haven't seen that in a while.
Mm. I think it's in his big box of tools.
Okay. It's good to see that is a usable solution. That you can have it all in one little tiny... Because you could have that in a teeny tiny little stick these days.
Yes. Because, when you net boot in the tool for creating bootable USB sticks for installing actually has an option if you're using an Ubuntu ISO to create some space for you to save your files to as well.
Yeah.
Alongside the live system, which is quite cool.
Interesting stuff. Scott Hewitt has written in to say,
on 27th and 28th of October, Adam Jansch and I are planning on carrying out a 24-hour commentary of the Hack Manchester event online via a stream / Google Hangout. You can find out more about Hack Manchester at the Hack Manchester website, which is hackmanchester.com. We'll put a link in the show notes. Yeah.
Well, good luck, Scott and Adam. 24 hours broadcasting is a challenge.
Yeah, you'll catch us doing that.
No way. We struggled to make it through an hour. Yeah. We've had two lots of cake already this evening.
Yeah.
Imagine there's not enough cake in the world to get us through a 24-hour show.
Or tea.
Yeah, or tea, yeah.
Open Energy Monitor tweeted,
does anyone know if Sage Instant Accounts 2012, brackets version 18, close brackets, runs on Ubuntu under Wine?
I can tell you where to look. If you go to appdb.winehq.com, that might be .org, and search for Sage Instant Accounts 2012, you'll find out.
Yes, that's usually the first place to look. Or just try it.
Or just try it, yeah. I mean, yeah. It's Wine's pretty good these days.
Wine and then the install name, installer executable name. Yeah. See how far you get,
or just double click the .exe file.
Yeah,
if you do that.
Yeah, cool.
If you do go on WineDB, it sometimes tells you there's another little command line tool called WineTrix, which will do things like install .NET and install Visual C++ and other sort of underlying runtime stuff, which it might need. And people tend to document that on WineHQ, so that might be a good place to look.
Excellent.
Russell Phillips tweeted,
I've just found out about.
Yeah. You even got to the hard
That's
bit,
140
yeah?
characters already there.
I've just found out about Codedojo.
Codedojo.
Mm. Worth mentioning on the podcast, and that's codedojo.com. Yes, it is worth mentioning on the podcast. Thank you for mentioning it.
What's a Codedojo then, Mark?
A Codedojo, Joe.
I'm not Joe.
Is,
good thing he's not called Joe.
It's a sort of non-profit movement. Or not for profit, I'm not sure exactly which.
Non-profit.
Not for profit.
Not for profit. Oh, okay. Which is about sort of organising workshops for kids to learn how to program. So they sort of match up mentors with people who want to learn and do stuff with them to teach them. Sort of like Young Rewired State sort of thing, but not specifically focusing on open data stuff, I suppose.
Yeah, sounds really cool.
And there's quite a lot of them. It seems to be enormous in Ireland. There seems to be one everywhere in Ireland and quite a few in the US and some in London, but not very widely dispersed in the UK other than that, unfortunately.
Mm. Well, cool. Thanks for pointing that out to us, Russ. And if you're interested, find out more, codedojo.com. Well, that is all for this episode. Thank you for listening. You can find out how to get in touch with us on our website, which is at the following address, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org. And on that website, you can find our voicemail numbers, where you can send us messages using Skype or SIP or a plain old telephone. You can find our Twitter feed, our Facebook, and even a Google Plus page, and details of our IRC channel, where there's some dedicated people hanging out all the way through the week wanting to talk about this show. Actually, they talk about other stuff mostly. But yeah, let us know what you think of this show, or give us your thoughts about Ubuntu and the community that makes it. You can join us again on Tuesday the 6th of November for our next live broadcast. What's happening on that show? Do we know?
It's my half birthday.
Is that when we get extra cake?
Yes.
Birthday
I think
cake.
So.
Super Engineer in the RC channel just said Argos use Nopix.
He also said it's a secret.
Whoops. Oh. Was I not supposed to say that? I wonder what they use it for.
Booting machines.
Do you think their stop control system runs on Nopix? It's actually just a live CD.
I can't think of anything funny enough in the short enough time. So we can say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.